the clothing filthy, the hair matted and infested with lice, even the teeth in their mouths loose and beginning to rot. He wanted to tell her that she owed them nothing, despite the fact that her mother was dying. But then there was her name, Edric, and what she might feel if she did not make this final effort to release the past.
"I do wish you were here," she said.
"Why is that?" "I'm not much good in the counselling department."
"But you're very good in the being with me department. I'd ask you to go with me, just to be there."
"Ah. Well, at this moment it can't be helped. I've rather made my bed, and unless I sort out this matter, my next likely bit of employment will be walking a beat in Penzance, or alongside Barbara, in Berwick-upon-Tweed. So whatever you decide, you must go it alone. I'll be with you in spirit, though. But let me say that these sorts of things, the things that hang over us, it does seem best to put them at rest if the opportunity comes up to do so. This may be it. I hate to say that, but there you have it. I hope you're not sorry you rang." There was a pause. Quite a long one. For a moment he thought they might have been cut off. He finally said her name. She said,
"Oh, yes, yes, I'm still here. I was just considering."
"Whether to go?"
"Not at all. I'm going to Cornwall."
"Then?"
"I was considering whether I'd ever be sorry that I rang you, Tommy."
"Dare I ask?"
"I wouldn't be. Sorry, that is, no matter how this present thing works out."
They rang off then, and Lindley remained where he was for a moment, sitting on the room's only chair at the narrow table that served as a desk. He examined his heart and its steady beating, and he wondered what it meant in one's life, making a decision to love again after terrible loss. He was still holding his mobile, so when it rang another time, he answered without looking to see that it was Isabel phoning this time. She said with no preamble,
"Is there more?"
He didn't ask what she meant, and he didn't sugarcoat the matter, which he might have done had he not just spoken to Deirdre, and heard her wish that he be with her on the journey to Cornwall, which of course he could not be. So he said bluntly, "Ian Druitt had a mobile. He had a car as well. We've come up with both. We've also come up with the fact that West Mercia's deputy chief constable is mother of the boy you interviewed. She and the forensic pathologist who examined Druitt's body belong to the same gliding group, by the way. Apparently they own a glider together. The deputy chief constable, she's called Clover Freeman, rang the PCSO's sergeant and gave the order to fetch Ian Druitt for questioning. All of this leads to a single point. Barbara was on the right track when she wrote the report that you ordered her to change." Isabel was silent, perhaps evaluating what this meant. The fact that she might be doing so made Linley's hackles rise. He said, "What the hell were you thinking, telling Barbara to alter that report? You were sent up here to—"
"Don't you dare tell me my job," she snapped.
"Look into what the IPCC made of their investigation into a custody death, and that's exactly what Barbara was trying to do. We have 19 days between an anonymous call that led to an arrest and the arrest itself. And during those 19 days, Isabel, there was, we have learned, no investigation done into Druitt, which means there was no apparent reason for his arrest. That's where Barbara was trying to head. So why the hell did you stop her?"
"We weren't in Ludlow to do anything more than look at what the IPCC did in their investigation after Druitt died. Not before he died, and that's exactly what we did. The rest is irrelevant."
"Are you goddamn mad?"
"How dare you speak to me like that?
Who the hell do you think that horse isn't nearly high enough, Isabel?" "I suggest you dismount. And while you're doing that, consider this. Clive Druitt came to the hotel to meet with us. He knew you'd been drinking when he spoke to you. He could smell it on you. Since he mentioned it to me, you can't possibly think he didn't also mention it to his MP. And what his MP did with the information..." He let her consider that as well. She finally said,
"Now this,"
in a near whisper. To which she added, in an altered tone,
"What's it going to take, eh? You're thinking that, aren't you, Tommy?"
He didn't bother to deny anything, because indeed he'd been thinking along those exact lines. At the same time, though, he felt the compassion of someone who has watched this sort of thing play out before. "Isabel, listen to me. You're not the first person, and you won't be the last," he said. "If it were easy, people placed into your position, having lost nearly everything, would just stop. You'd just stop because you love your sons and because you've lost both them and your marriage at your own doing. It's very possible that now you stand to lose your job as well. At some level, you see this. But the monster still has you, and unless you shake it off your back, no matter how the hell you do it, you're going to die. Do you understand that?"
Even remotely?
Don't be dramatic with me, Tommy. I'm not that far gone. You see me as standing on the brink, but that's not what this is. It's not where I am.
He raised his gaze to the ceiling, to the heavens, to whatever being existed who could possibly get through to her. From his experience within his own family, though, he understood that the only person who would be able to reach Isabel Ardrey was going to be Isabel Ardrey, and then it would happen only when she'd had enough of the cock-up she'd made of her life. He said, "We're speaking with the PCSO this morning, I hope. We tried to arrange it yesterday, but we weren't able to make contact. Barbara left him a voicemail, but other than a note he left for her at reception, that was it. We're taking a stab with Finnegan Freeman as well. What did you make of him?"
"He plays at working-class boy-making good. He's quite adept with the accent, and he has the gruesome habit of talking with his mouth full, of burrito when I saw him. He's a strong advocate for Ian Druitt's innocence in all things."
"It's interesting, then, isn't it, that he knew Druitt, and that Druitt's arrest was called for by his own mother?" The DCS was quiet for a moment. Linley knew that she fully understood how much she had missed because of her haste to be finished with Ludlow. There was no point in underscoring that another time. She finally said,
"Good hunting, then, Tommy. You might be able to get more from the PCSO. Barbara was right. I do see that."
That, he decided, was the first hopeful thing he'd heard from her. They rang off, then. It was time to get down to the business of the day. Ludlow, Shropshire. Rabia Lomax had long ago learned that a morning run cleared her head for whatever she had to face that day. She had developed the habit during the trying adolescent years of her two sons. Up before dawn, out in the early morning streets, she was able to dismiss her concerns about David's drinking, always claimed on his part to be experimental only, and Tim's dabbling with marijuana. She could tell herself that this was her time, and that she would get back to her sons and their difficulties later. When she left the house on the morning following the second call upon her by the Metropolitan Police, she altered her normal route. Generally, she included the bread walk in her run, an earthen slice through the forest that carved beneath the ancient limes and alders, marking a route high above the River Teem. This path stretched from Lower Dinham Street all the way to the Ludford Bridge, and on many mornings it afforded one a pleasing view of the dawn breaking over the town's ancient rooftops. But this day she needed Teemside to be part of her route, so she headed in that direction from St. Julian's Well. She wanted to look at the house where Dina Donaldson lived. She'd had a phone conversation with her granddaughter on the previous evening, and as things turned out, Ding had unexpectedly become a part of it. Rabia didn't like lying. She'd always adhered to the philosophy, tell the truth because there's less one must remember that way. Out of necessity, however, she lied to the Metropolitan Police upon their first visit, because it was the simpler thing to do, given the circumstances. But to have now lied to the Metropolitan Police a second time was something that she could see as having the potential to fill her life and the lives of her family with unexpected sinkholes. So after looking at the possible alternatives she could choose from once the police had left her, she knew that she had to ring Missa. She hadn't done the first time round because it hadn't seemed necessary. Besides, there had existed in her family an atmosphere of letting sleeping dogs lie for quite some time, and Rabia had gone along with it, hoping for the best and telling herself that it was not her place to intervene in the lives of her adult children, their spouses, and their offspring. But upon reviewing the two visits she'd had from the Met, what they said, what she said, what they asked, and how she answered, she altered the hands-off approach she'd long taken with her boys and their families. When it was late enough for Missa to be in her bedroom and out of earshot of her parents, Rabia punched in the number of the girl's mobile. She went directly at it with her granddaughter.
"Tell me about the appointments you had with Ian Druitt, Missa."
There was a considerable pause. During it, Rabia heard a wannabe 1940s crooner singing in the background. She wondered if a talent program was playing on telly. Evidently, Missa was watching it on her own because the sound went off, and then she said,
"What are you talking about, Gran?" "I've had two encounters with detectives from the Metropolitan Police on the subject of Ian Druitt. I'd like to avoid having any additional conversations with them, although I know that might not be possible." "Do you mean the London police?" "That's exactly who I mean. The first time they were here, I had Aeschylus hold my hand and do the talking. This time I went it alone. They're hunting down a Lomax who met with a deacon of St. Lawrence Church. This is Ian Druitt, as I expect you know, and while I declared that Lomax to be myself..."
"Why did you do that? Did you know him, Gran?"
"I'm uneasy having done so.
Not so much because I don't wish to lie to the police, although I don't wish to lie to the police, but because I dislike lying blindfolded. Now, what did you and Mr. Jewett meet about? If I'm to keep lying, I'd like to know what I'm dealing with.
There was another pause. Its length did not suggest that Missus' next words were entirely reliable.
Gran, I never met with Mr. Jewett at all. Then why would our surname be in his diary 7 times? 7 times? I don't have any reason to meet any deacon of any church 1 time, let alone 7. Someone must have done it using our name. Would there be any reason in the world for that?
Even as she asked the question, however, Rabia could herself come up with a list of answers. It began ominously with, "Lest someone find out."
"Probably," was Missus's answer.
It hung there for a bit before she added,
"Gran, it has to be Ding. Why on earth?" She must have been talking to him about how to cope with Brutus. Bruce Castle. He's her, well, sort of her boyfriend. They seem to lurch from crisis to crisis. At least that's how it was when I was in Ludlow. Or could be she was talking to Mr. Druitt about wanting to make some changes in her life and not knowing how to do it. I don't expect she meant anything by it, though. I mean, to cause any trouble by using our name. I don't like anyone using our name, no matter how or why, Rabia told her. I intend to speak to Ding about this,
Missa said quickly.
Gran, please don't do that. Why, ever not? It's just that she's had such a rotten time of it because of Brutus. He cheats on her, and he expects her to be fine with that, and she's not at all, but she's been pretending, and now she's finally got up her courage to end things with him. I wouldn't want the fact that she used our name to be the thing that makes her back off from tossing Brutus from her life, you see?
The fact was, Rabia didn't see. It was one thing staying out of the lives of her sons and their families. It was quite another if someone not of the family was asking her to do the same while putting her family in a bad position. Now she crossed the river where dawn cast a glow upon the water. On its placid surface a lone swan floated. It preened its feathers before rising up to unsettle its wings. Incredible, the size and aspect of the bird, Rabia thought. Swans looked so gentle, so placid, so accepting. And then, in an instant, they altered. Lights were beginning to come on in the house's long Teamside, but at the house where Dina Donaldson lived all was still, and what Rabia could see of the interior through the front bay window looked full of shadows. She paused there and considered Ding, what she knew about her already, and what she'd learned from Missa on the previous night. She wanted to feel sorry for the girl with her cheating boyfriend and his expectations that she should be happy to accept however little he was willing to toss her way. And at one level, Rabia did feel sorry for her. But she also decided to ignore Missa's wishes in the matter. Rabia would talk to Dina Donaldson. She was far from satisfied that she'd gotten to the heart of Lomax times 7 in a dead man's diary. Ludlow, Shropshire. Ding had spent a restless night. Her conversation with Francie Adamucci had asked her to examine herself and to reach a conclusion about why she was so bloody overwrought about Brutus being with anyone, when she, Dina Donaldson, had spent the last 5 years and counting doing practically the same thing in Much Wenlock, and with any bloke who looked at her twice. "It's who I am," didn't work as a rationale for the way she'd been going at life, though. That might have done the trick for Brutus, but it went nowhere when it came to her, because "it's who I am" suggested "it's who I'll always be." And setting herself up as Shropshire's foremost fuck-machine was not what Ding had ever entertained as a lifetime ambition. One wouldn't know that from what she'd done on the previous night, however. She'd gone out alone. She told herself that she needed a break from struggling with a paper she owed her tutor, but as she'd only written a single sentence of that paper, she moved straight off the idea of a respite from essay writing, and from there she went to telling herself that the air would do her good, because the room was stuffy and a brisk walk would help her organize her thoughts. Reality turned out to be somewhat different, as her brisk walk took her directly to the Hart and Hind, where she had not been, on her own, that is, since she'd run off from Jack Corhanan and room 2 upstairs from the pub. She wouldn't have approached the bar itself had anyone known to her been inside the place, but no one had been, which meant that if she wanted a drink she had to give her order to one of them, Jack or his nephew. She would easily have managed ordering herself a lager and making that all she did, aside from drinking it down, had the nephew remained behind the bar. But as she approached, Jack said,
"That may handle this, Peter. You see to the glassware,"
which took the nephew off to clear tables. At that point, Jack said to her, "You best be explicit with what you want this time round. We don't need to misunderstand each other again, do we?"
She said, "I don't know what you're talking about."
He said, "Let me put it this way, then. Are you here to wet your whistle, or to wet something else?"
"That's incredibly rude."
"Isn't it just? But rude works a treat for me, darling. Only question is, does rude work for you? See, first time I saw you in here, months and months ago this was, I reckoned you as a match for me. I thought, she's a hot one, she is. It'll only be a matter of weeks before she gives me the signal."
"Well, it wasn't weeks, was it?"
"True, it took a wee bit more time, but there it was all the same. You wet, me hard. And the rest."
"You're not a gentleman, you know."
"On that, we see eye to eye. Is it a gentleman you want, coming in here alone? Or is it something a bit more thrilling? Or is the truth that you're a tease like before, and when it comes to the rest of it, there's something not quite right in your head?"
"There's nothing wrong with me, or my head. Proof is in the pudding, as they say.
Could be the way I see you is different to how you see yourself."
"I'm fine. I'm just fine."
He nodded. "So you say. But if I were you, I'd want to prove it. See, girls your age, oftentimes they don't know what they're about. They get themselves into situations, don't they? And all of a sudden, the picture they thought they were going to paint isn't the one they find themselves painting. When that happens, well, you know, off they scurry into the night." Ding knew damn well what he was talking about. But that was then, and this was now, and things were not what they had been. She said,
"You think that, Jack Corhanan? You just give me one of those keys. We can get this straightened out fast enough."
Jack turned to the Corhanan nephew, who, to Ding's embarrassment, had been close enough to hear the exchange. Jack said to him, "What do you think, Peter, my lad? Should I give little Missy here another chance?" "You don't want to, I will," Peter replied as he hoisted a plastic bin of glasses onto the bar. "Can't have that," his uncle told him. He reached behind the till, handed one of the room keys to Ding, and said, "5 minutes, darling. Be ready this time." So she was. Every thread removed from her body, standing in front of the window with her back to the glass and her face in the shadows, she found she wasn't the least bit nervous. When it came to proving to herself who she was, Dina Donaldson was never nervous. When Jack came into the room, she walked to him. His hair was longish and thick, and she grabbed onto it with one hand and pulled his head to her mouth. As he kissed her, she felt for his dick. Hard already. Good, she thought. She would make it harder. She would make him want it in ways he'd never wanted it before, and they would do it in ways he'd never done it before. So she set upon that course, and she saw it through, and if the publican knew nothing else about Dina Donaldson by 2 in the morning, what he was absolutely sure of was that Dina Donaldson was not a tease. She went home, sore. She staggered into the house and up the stairs, thinking she would be comatose in 30 seconds after all that had passed, but instead of that she was left with, "What's wrong with you, Ding?" She could fuck till she dropped from the face of the planet, but she could see that it would not come close to answering the question. When she could no longer put it off, Ding groaned and rolled to the edge of her bed. She stuck her legs out and contemplated getting up and having a shower, and perhaps going to a lecture. She was on her way to committing herself to those actions when her mobile rang. It was on the bedside table, so she answered it without checking to see who was ringing her. When she heard the voice, the name and the occupation, though, she wished she'd let the call go to a message she could easily ignore.
"Is that Dina Donaldson?" a woman's voice asked. "This is Greta Yates, the college counsellor. You're going to need to come to my office. If you have an interest in remaining here at West Mercia College, that is, have you that interest?"
Ding hadn't, actually. But she had less interest in being rusticated, so she said yes, 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 indeed. When did Miss Yates want to see her? Ludlow, Shropshire. Barbara told Lindley they could walk to the police station easily enough, but it was his decision to drive. Who knew where their conversation with Gary Ruddock might lead them, was his reason. If they needed to track down someone or something once they spoke with the PCSO, it would save time to have the car available. When they left the hotel at 8:30, Barbara directed Lindley to the police station, realizing as she did so that the required route via car, instead of on foot, would take them directly past the house in which Finnegan Freeman lived. She pointed it out as they cruised past. She also brought Lindley into the picture of what she'd discovered about someone's being able to access the police station on foot or by bicycle from this location. Unlike the DCS, Linley nodded thoughtfully as he took this on board. He said, "Good work, Barbara. That bit of information could turn out quite useful." When they reached the station on the corner of Townsend Close and Lower Galderford, they found the PCSO waiting for them, leaning against his patrol car in the car park. He held up a takeaway coffee in a form of greeting, and he came to be introduced to Linley as soon as they'd parked.
"I expect you'd like to see inside the place," he said, indicating the unmanned police station.
Linley said that having a look inside would be welcome, especially having a look at the office where Ian Druitt died. Raddick said it was ready and waiting. The door, he told him, was already unlocked. Barbara could show him where the office was. He reckoned they might like to make their inspection without himself lurking in the background. Although there wasn't much to see, Barbara appreciated this, as it would allow a more open conversation between Linley and herself. So she led the way, with Linley following and Ruddock having a seat on the back steps, where he put on his sunglasses against the sunlight of what was clearly going to be a beautiful spring day. Barbara took Linley to the office in which the deacon had died. As before, there was little enough to see. The desk, with its battered rolling chair tucked into the knee-hole, an empty bulletin board, bits of tape still stuck to the walls where maps had probably once hung, the coat cupboard, and the doorknob that had served the purpose of ending Ian Druitt's life. She told him what she herself had been told by Dr. Scannell, how suicide was managed in this way through the pressure exerted on the jugular veins, resulting in venous congestion, resulting in unconsciousness and death. Linley observed as she spoke. He pulled out the rolling desk chair, but there appeared to be nothing untoward about it. He prowled the room, eyeing everything from the dust on the windowsills to the scuff marks on the lino. When they left the office, she took him to see the rest as well, the former lunchroom, the monitors behind the reception counter upon which the CCTV cameras could display their documentation of anyone's coming and going, the computers used by patrol officers who came and went from the station during their duty hours, the other offices in which someone might have been lying in wait. She ended with taking him outside to show him how easily the position of the CCTV camera could be altered above the station's main entrance. Their tour completed, they rejoined Gary Ruddock, who quickly rose from the back steps and dusted off the seat of his trousers.
"Helpful at all?" he asked.
"Everything helps, I find," Linley replied. He leaned against the brick wall of the station, his gaze on the car park. Barbara waited to see what sort of conversation Linley had in mind to have with Gary Ruddock, post their inspection of the police building. Linley said, "I've had a look through Druitt's motor. How well did you know him?"
"Not especially well at all. I knew him to nod at in the street, saying hello and that sort of thing. And, of course, I knew where to find him. I mean that he was connected to St. Lawrence Church."
"That's it, then?"
"Pretty much it is."
Ruddock joined Linley in gazing at the car park. Then he added,
"Is there something you reckon I ought to have known about him? Like, did you find something inside his car?"
"Interesting question. Why do you ask?"
"Well, I don't expect the bloke was dealing drugs on the side or anything, but as there was that phone call about paedophilia..."
"Do you mean pornographic photos or the like?" "No, there was nothing along those lines. Although, no one's mentioned a relationship Druitt might have had. But he's got a box of condoms in his glove box. I may well be stereotyping him, but the condoms do seem rather unexpected in the car of an unmarried church deacon."
"I expect he was giving them to young people," Ruddock said. "He was round them a good bit, through the church and whatever else."
"He did know the Freeman boy," Barbara pointed out. "The DCC herself told us that. How Finnegan helped out Druitt at the children's club. Did you know about that, Gary?"
He nodded.
"Could be the condoms were for him, then. Or, like I said, for other lads his age. Kids get up to things, and I can see a churchman worrying about that."
"That makes sense if they weren't Druitts," Linley noted.
"How old is the Freeman boy?" Barbara asked.
She answered her own question with,
18? 19? "I suppose Druitt could have learned from him that he and the girlfriend were up to the usual, only just like a lot of kids, he wasn't using protection, so it could have turned into a case of whoops, and Druitt was trying to prevent this."
Ruddock didn't respond. His silence of a sudden seemed strange to Barbara. She rued that he'd donned sunglasses. She couldn't tell if he was thinking this over or thinking of a way he could avoid thinking this over. In either case, she didn't see what the actual need for silence might have been, aside from the fact that he didn't want to get into Finnegan Freeman, since there was a known connection between Finn Freeman and the dead man, and the boy's mother was a high-ranking official in the same police force as Gary Ruddock.
"On a stretch," she finally said, "it could also be that the allegations against Druitt were true. that he was messing about the children but wearing a condom to keep things tidy, if you know what I mean.
There's that as well, Lindley said. As unpleasant as the painted picture is, I might add, Sergeant.
That anonymous message did bang in the direction of paedophilia, Ruddock said.
Yes. Although one has some trouble with the idea of your garden paedophilia using protection. Everything considered, it seems more likely that Druitt was handing out the condoms to older boys. Or he had a relationship with someone, and we might want to suss out who that person is.
But, can I ask? Ruddock seemed hesitant, but plunged on when Lindley nodded. Where does that lead you?
I mean the condoms, and why Druitt even had them.
To be honest, it probably leads nowhere, Lindley said.
But it's something to follow up on, and in the absence of anything else, I always like seeing where things will take us.
Merway, Shropshire. They decided to speak with Flora Bevans. Where there was evidence, in the form of the condoms, suggesting present lovers, former lovers, married lovers, vengeful spouses, arguments, conflicts, tears, and any one of the passions and the deadly sins, logic dictated it be investigated. If Gary Ruddock could only speculate about Druitt's possession of the condoms, perhaps Flora Bevans could do more. While Lindley set a course out of town, Barbara combed through the notes she'd taken of the conversations she'd had with the individuals attached to those names in Druitt's diary that she had been able to track down. There hadn't been a ghost of a suggestion anywhere that the man had a relationship with anyone save his God. But then she hadn't questioned any of these people on that actual topic. She was probably going to have to deal with them all again, should Flora Bevans be unable to give them happiness on the subject of condoms. The Bevans Beauty's van was in the driveway when they arrived, suggesting the florist was at home. To Barbara's leaning upon the bell, the woman herself answered the door, her mobile phone pressed to her ear and a finger already raised to tell her visitors she would be with them when she could. Her eyebrows lifted in surprise when she saw Barbara, and she said into her phone, "Hang on just a moment," and then to Barbara, "I didn't think I'd be seeing you again," to which Barbara replied, "This is D.R. Lindley. Can we have a word?" Flora opened wide the door, saying, "Come in, come in. I'm just finishing up with an order." She retreated towards the back of the house, saying into the phone, "You see, the size of the urn is more important than it would seem upon first consideration, if it overwhelms where it's placed." Barbara and Lindley had remained in the entry, and Lindley murmured, "Cremations?" to her. She frowned and said, "What?" He said, "Urns. Cremations."
"Oh, she does plantings, sir. Big pots and the like. Huge pots, actually, for people's front steps, and I reckon for their back gardens as well, and inside their houses, and wherever."
Flora Bevans joined them then, saying,
"Sorry, I've been talked into a garden wedding, all the pots and urns to be fixtures in the garden afterwards, which means the bride must be pleased with the colours, the mother of the bride must be able to work with the colours afterwards, as it is her garden, and the mother of the groom has apparently already chosen her kit for the affair, and the flowers must not clash with that, nor must they clash with the gown of the chief attendant, who is apparently going to be dressed in fuchsia. Appalling choice even for a summer wedding. But there you have it. Now, you've returned, and I have a feeling this hasn't to do with your ordering up a few urns for your terrace. Sorry, I cannot remember your name."
Barbara reintroduced herself, and then Lindley.
"Is this about poor Ian?" Flora asked. "Do you want to see his room again?"
Barbara said to her,
"We've come to talk to you about condoms, actually." "Good heavens. Do come in. You have me in the dither of intrigue."
She ushered them into a sitting room, saying,
"Please sit. Shove those magazines onto the floor, Inspector. May I get you something? Tea, coffee, water? Oh, I didn't see Geoffrey there. Excuse me, let me post him elsewhere."
Geoffrey turned out to be a cat with fur that virtually matched the sofa's upholstery. He was curled into a corner of it, and he looked up just before Barbara planted her bum on top of him. His expression indicated that he wasn't pleased to see any of them. He protested with something between a meow and a trill as Flora gathered him up. But as posting him elsewhere consisted of placing him on the top of the largest cat tree that Barbara had ever seen, in order to give him a view of the street, he didn't seem entirely unforgiving that his nap had been interrupted. Both Barbara and Lindley demurred on refreshments, so all of them sat. Flora said,
"I don't know how much help I can be. Condoms. Heavens! Am I blushing just to say the word?"
"They were in Ian Druitt's car," Lindley told her.
"Were they indeed? Was he being naughty?"
"Or careful," Barbara pointed out.
"Of course, of course. But how can I help you with Ian and his condoms?"
"Possession of them indicates use," Lindley said. Flora chewed on this one and its implications, Barbara said.
What the inspector means is, were you and Ian Druitt lovers?
Good gracious, no.
I did tell you and the other officer that between us there was simply no frisson, did I not? I doubt he looked upon me as anything other than his landlady. For my part, I never gave a thought to him as anything. Perhaps I should say any one I would want in my bed. I don't mean to imply there was anything wrong with him, mind. He was quite a lovely chap, but the truth is that aside from there being no chemistry between us, sex with one's lodger does bring up the dicey issue of what next. Does one still expect to have the rent paid on time? Was this a one-off, or can one expect a repeat performance? And if so, when? So if Ian was carrying condoms about with him, I was not his intended, beneficiary?
Did he ever mention any other beneficiary to you? Lindley asked.
Even clothed as someone you might not have suspected was a beneficiary at all, Barbara added. Well, that's rather difficult, isn't it? Flora said. Ian knew so many people, not only through the parish and the church, but also through all his activities. Really, it could have been anyone.
Male and female? Lindley asked.
Goodness, I have absolutely no idea. But if he was engaged with someone, you know what I mean, then he was the absolute soul of discretion. He never mentioned a name or received a phone call or even a letter or a card in the post. And when I packed up his things after his most unfortunate death, I surely would have seen something. A pressed flower, a theatre stop, one half of a cinema ticket, to indicate he had a lover.
A married woman? Lindley asked Flora Bevans.
I suppose that could be the case, she said. Although again, Inspector, there was no sign.
Someone underage? Barbara offered.
Oh, dear. One hates even to think of Ian in that capacity. A man of God, and a young girl. I always felt completely safe with him in the house, you know.
No one's suggesting that he was engaged in criminal behaviour, Lindley reassured her.
Well, except for the paedophilia thing, sir, Barbara said.
Yes, of course.
Oh, I can barely stand to talk about that. I don't believe it. I can't picture Ian doing anything of the sort. I do wish I could be more help to you. But from everything I saw and heard and overheard, well, the house is small, as you can see, regarding Ian, I can give you nothing save the fact that he seemed to be a complete man of God. I hope I'm not wrong.
She sighed, putting her hands on her thighs, and stood.
I am sorry not to be of more help, she concluded. You've trekked all this way out here for nothing.
Barbara dug round in her bag for a card to give the florist, and she handed it over with the usual remark about ringing if anything came to her mind. She and Lindley stood as well. They were heading towards the front door when it occurred to Barbara that Flora Bevans might be able to aid them with something else. She asked the florist whether Ian Druitt had known the date of her birth. He'd lived with her for some years, after all. Flora responded with,
"What an odd question, but yes, he did know,"
and when Barbara asked her for it, she told her. Before the florist could inquire about why the police wanted her birthday, Barbara flipped her notebook closed and said,
"Thanks, I'll remember to send you a card."
They were out in the street before she tried the relevant numbers on Ian Druitt's locked phone. She smiled and looked up from the phone to Lindley.
"Bingo,"
she said.
Bromfield, Shropshire. Since they were on the Bromfield Road, they drove from Flora Bevan's house into Bromfield itself, where a secondary road near the post office took them to what one could reliably find in any village in the country, a pub. The journey took all of 8 minutes, two of which were spent overshooting the lane upon which the pub was established, and thereby requiring Lindley to find the rough tractor entrance to a farmer's field where he could execute a 3-point turn. During all of this, Havers devilled with Druitt's mobile phone, which, of course, had not been used since the night of his death. She finally said to him,
"Treasure trove, sir. God bless smartphones. As the song says, we're in the money. Where did it come from, that song, by the way?"
"The larger question is where you might have heard it," Lindley pointed out to her. "It's not 1950s rock and roll, after all."
"It can, however, be tap danced to," she informed him.
"Ah, as to that, Deirdre wished me to inquire how it's going. The tap dancing, that is."
"Deirdre? What the bloody hell?"
"She's one of the intrigued, Sergeant. As am I hope you recall. How is it all going? I ask because daily I fear a phone call from Dee Harriman. I'll need something to report in order to remain in her good graces."
"Tell her I'm a dead cert when it comes to the heel drop, but the Irish is slaying me. Umaima remains the better bet if Dee doesn't want egg on her tap shoes on the night in question."
"Remind me when it is, Sergeant Havers?"
"In your dreams, Inspector Linley. Not a bloody chance."
The pub, they discovered, was not only the local watering hole but also a gathering spot for an ambitious male knitting group that appeared to be taking instruction from a pensioner who looked as if he'd spent most of his life on the sea, so weathered was his skin. They seemed to be working all on the same kind of project. This could have been an extremely long sock, or a rather short scarf. It was difficult to tell, although the colours chosen by the knitters suggested something of a military nature. Their lesson was accompanied by a good amount of libation. It appeared to be adding a great deal to their enjoyment, if the noise was anything to go by. As Linley and Havers took a table, the sergeant pulled her notebook from her bag once again. She said to him,
"Did you know these lovely gizmos?"
And here she waved the mobile in the air.
"Keep a record of your calls directly on them, for a couple of months back, without you having to ask anyone to send them to you. Calls made and calls received, and calls missed and messages left. And since, as we know, this particular mobile hasn't been used since the night Ian Druitt died, we're sitting pretty. Or at least prettier than we would have been with an older type phone. Anyway, if you put on your country pub persona and fetch me a lemonade from the bar, sir, I'll see what's what with the who's, the whys, and the howevers."
"Anything else?" he asked her before turning towards the bar.
"I wouldn't say no to a packet of something edible. Salt and vinegar crisps, if they have 'em. Port rinds will do in a pinch. There's the lad."
Linley shuddered but did her bidding. In the minutes that it took him to get the attention of the publican, purchase a lemonade, a packet of crisps, and a cup of coffee, which extended the wait since the coffee had to be made, and return to their table, Havers was able to go through the first few weeks of Ian Druitt's phone calls. She was using her notes to compare the phone numbers with those she'd compiled from the deacon's various church and volunteer activities as listed in his diary. She was on to the fourth week as Linley set his purchases upon the table.
"Ta," she said to him, "dig into the crisps, if you've a mind, Inspector."
"I shall pass," he told her.
"Could you do the honours anyway?"
He opened the bag and handed it over to her. She unceremoniously dumped its contents onto the tabletop, oblivious to germs, bacteria, social diseases, and the remains of meals. She tucked in directly. Linley reckoned that, at this point in her life, Havers had an immune system worthy of advanced scientific study. As she munched, she reported on her findings.
"We've got Mr. Spencer, a woman I spoke to earlier from the Neighbourhood Watch program, Flora Bevans, the two crime victims listed in his diary, his dad, and the bloke who heads up the feral cat catch-and-release group. There are some other calls to and from numbers I don't have in my notes, and I'll ring them and see what's what when I've finished with the first of the 2 months we've got."
Linley nodded as he stirred some questionable-looking sugar into his coffee, trying to avoid the bits that were clotted together from wet spoons having previously been dipped into the bowl. He said, "So far, then, there's not a lot of joy to be had?"
"Could be the case, sir. But there's something missing, and there's also another phone number that I wouldn't expect to be here."
"Indeed. Continue." She shoved a handful of crisps into her mouth, munched, and washed them down with a gulp of lemonade. She said,
"First, unless one of these phone numbers is attached to Rabia Lomax's mobile, assuming she has one, there's no phone call either received or made that deals with her. That's curious, you ask me, since she had those sessions with Druitt, and one would think she'd need to ring him about an appointment."
"It could be that she contacted him prior to this 2 month period you got on his phone, Barbara. If she did that in order to set up her first appointment, there wouldn't be a reason to ring him again, would there?"
"I suppose," Havers agreed. "Assuming that at the end of each appointment she's set up the next right there in his presence. On the other hand, could be she's lying to us."
"It does remain a disagreeable fact of our employment that someone is usually lying about something. What else, then?"
"Gary Raddick."
"What about him?"
"In the weeks I've looked at so far, Druitt rang him 5 times, and during that same period on his end, Raddick rang Druitt 3 times.
"Did he indeed?
I reckon we ought to take that one on board and stow it with the baggage, since he claimed barely to know the bloke."
She reached for another palmful of crisps and munched happily.
"Seemed to me, sir, Ruddock went dead quiet when the Freeman kid was brought up. I wonder if he was hoping we'd move off that topic before he had to address it."
"Or to answer questions about him. The boy, I mean."
"Right."
"There's something not quite as it should be in what he said about Druitt, then."
"Ruddock? Too right. And here's what it is for me, Inspector. One phone call between him and Druitt? Okay, whatever. It could be dismissible. But 8? That's dressed in neon lights, that is."
"We can't discount Druitt and the victim volunteer bit, however.
It stands to reason that Ruddock might well have put him in touch with several victims of crimes.
He might have done. But there would have had to be a real crime spree in Ludlow, since the calls back and forth span something like...
She referred to the phone.
11 days.
He nodded thoughtfully. Could be it's to do with the boy, then. Finnegan.
The Gov thought he was a piece of work. Could be he was up to something and Druitt knew what it was. Or Ruddock knew what it was and told Druitt to keep an eye out on the sly.
Drug dealing, housebreaking, muggings, graffiti, tagging, street fights.
We know he was into karate.
Chopping watermelons in half with his index finger. She raised her eyes heavenward.
Whatever, sir. But I've got to say it. There's things about this bloke, the PCSO, that are starting to make me feel like a dormouse is running round my insides. There's these dodgy bits we keep coming across, starting with when the DCS and I were here.
Elucidating that point?
She ticked items off an imaginary list on the tabletop. The CCTV camera in front of the station being shut down long enough to have its position moved. Whatever Ruddock might have been doing with a girl in his patrol car on the night Druitt died. Ruddock claiming he has no relationship with a female, when he clearly has something going on with her at the patrol car. Ruddock saying he left Druitt alone in that office while he was making phone calls to pubs. And now Ruddock not mentioning he and Druitt spoke by mobile. And there's probably more. I'm thinking we've not got all there is to be had from Gary Ruddock, sir. You ask me, we need thumbscrews.
You might well be right, Lindley said. But it seems that at the moment we have only one available to us.
One thumbscrew? What is it, then?
The PCSO's mobile phone. Since Druitt's mobile is something of a revelation, Ruddock's might be the same. Havers thought about this before saying,
We could go for his phone records. But that would take days, wouldn't it, assuming we could warm the cockles of some magistrates high enough to get a warrant for virtually no reason. And even with a warrant, it'll still take even more days to get the records, right? So do we have enough time from Hillier to be going that route?
You won't find me arguing that we do. I dare say we'll have to go at this directly, and more creatively. Since the constable has announced himself eager to help in any way he can, I suggest we take him up on his offer. Havers shot him an incredulous look.
You're saying we ask him to hand over his phone?
I am. When you think about it, how can he refuse? If we structure our conversation with him correctly, our request to look to his phone will be inevitable. Indeed, he might well offer it to us without our even having to make the request.
She took a moment to consider this before she said, You're a bloody wily one when you want to be, Inspector.
I like to think Wily is my middle name.
I'm on board, then.
She flipped her notebook closed and returned it to her bag. She put the mobile with the notebook. Then she wiped the salt and vinegar crisp crumbs from the table onto her hand. For a horrifying moment, Linley thought she might actually consume them as she dunned the crisps from the unhygienic surface of the table. She caught his expression and said,
Please, I draw the line somewhere, Inspector.
He said, Thank God, as she added,
I just don't do my line drawing here, and licked the crumbs from her palm.
Ludlow, Shropshire. While Barbara liked Linley's proposed direct approach to putting their maulers on Gary Ruddock's mobile, she wasn't sure how well it was going to work. The PCSO didn't know that they were in possession of the dead man's smartphone, of course, so that was to their advantage. On the other hand, since Ruddock had already indicated that he knew there was a connection between Finnegan Freeman and Ian Druitt, she didn't really see how going over a record of his phone calls to and from the man was going to serve the purpose of dealing with all the bits that were looking dodgy about the bloke. A quick call to the PCSO told them that he was not in the police station at the moment. Although he sounded just a bit surprised to hear that the Met detectives wished to speak with him again, he was otherwise cooperative. He told Barbara that at present he was at the Mobile Home Centre just outside Ludlow Business Park. One of the vehicles had been broken into. Did they want to meet him there? It was just off the A49. Or he could meet them back at the station. Unfortunately, it was locked, or he'd tell them just to wait inside till he got there. They chose the station, and Ruddock said he'd meet them there as soon as he could. He reckoned an hour would do, since he needed to finish up at the Mobile Home Centre. While Linley drove them back into Ludlow and then to the Nick, Barbara used the time to continue ringing the numbers registered on Ian Druitt's phone. She continued this as they waited for the PCSO's arrival, and the time allowed her to discover Druitt's connections with the head teachers from 3 nearby primary schools, all of whom were recommending youngsters for the children's club. Requests he'd made to parents of children in that club for transportation to a gymnastics exhibition, communications with a parish organist,
a request for a change in the choral music made by one of the choir members. She was also able to track down various calls he'd made to his father, his mother, and three of his siblings about a celebration of his paternal grandmother's 95th birthday. Several other numbers went directly to automated voicemail when she rang them, giving her no option but to request a return call from whoever it was who owned the phone. When she finished her work with the mobile, Linley told her that he had a conversational plan for Gary Ruddock that would make the PCSO's handing over his mobile to them inevitable. In the final moments before Ruddock's arrival, he explained it to her, and when at last Ruddock drove into the car park, they set upon that task. Barbara said to the PCSO as they joined him,
"Can we sit and have a natter, Gary? We've come across a few new details, me and the inspector."
"Course," Ruddock said. "I'm that happy to help." And he took them into the former lunchroom, where he and Barbara had sat before. He told them to hang on a moment so that he could fetch another chair. This one turned out to be a desk chair that he rolled down the corridor. Linley was the one to tell him that they were in possession of Ian Druitt's smartphone. He'd left it in the vestry, Linley said, the night that Ruddock had gone to St. Lawrence Church to fetch him to the police station. Ruddock nodded. He waited for more.
"We charged it up," Barbara said, "and once we finally worked out the proper code to unlock the bloody thing..."
"Thanks to Barbara's efforts," Linley added.
"Tar, sir," she said. "I do my best." And then to Ruddock, "Like I said, once we got the thing operational, we started looking through the calls, into and out of the phone, I mean."
Linley said, "Since it hadn't been used since March, it had a record of the calls for the last 2 months of the deacon's life." Ruddock surprised them with,
"My own number would have been there. He and I went back and forth a bit." "I recognised your number," Barbara told him. "We have him ringing you and you ringing him."
"We're speaking to everyone attached to the phone calls, clarifying why they phoned him and vice versa," Linley said. "So you'd want to know about the calls between us, me and Druitt, I wager." He looked from Barbara to Linley, back to Barbara.
"That'd be the case," she agreed.
"Can I have a look at the phone?" he asked. And Barbara handed it over to him. He said, "Goes back a bit, this does."
"That'd be because it's not been used since he died," Barbara said.
He nodded thoughtfully. He also seemed to consider what or how much he wanted to reveal. Finally, he said, "Well, it's nothing to do with what happened. See, he was ringing me about Finn Freeman." "The deputy chief constable's son," Linley said. "Druitt had some concerns about him. Truth to tell, there's always the odd concern when it comes to Finn. He's done something of a job with his looks, and he makes himself seem real rough round the edges. It's mostly an act, but he puts people off. I think Druitt was more watchful with him than he might have been with another lad, had another lad been his helper at the club." "Was he waiting for him to be out of order in some way?"
"Probably.
He rang wanting to know if Finn had ever been in any trouble in town. Aside from drinking too much, he hadn't been, which was what I told him." "He rang more than once, though. Can we assume he wasn't reassured?"
"Why, I recall. It was like he had a feeling about Finn, and he was looking for someone to support it, or perhaps to explain it away. I didn't have even a sprat to give him. The boy smokes weed now and again, but so do the rest of them. He drinks as well, but he's never been in any trouble round here. That's what I told Druitt. Eventually, though, he rang asking how to contact Finn's parents. He wouldn't tell me what it was about, just that he needed to speak with them and he didn't want the boy to know, so he couldn't ask him directly how to contact them. Somehow he knew Finn's mum was a police officer. I reckon Finn told him, or told the kids in the club. And he wanted to know from me, did I know how he could contact her without it getting back to Finn?"
"Ringing his parents suggests it was something fairly serious," Linley said. "Did he give you any idea at all what was going on?"
"I asked," Ruddock said, "but all he said was, 'I can't be sure,' and something like how he didn't want to judge the boy wrong. I got the impression he was worried about Finn's, well, I guess you'd call it his impact on the club's children. And he was hoping to get some information about him from his parents."
"What sort of information?"
"No clue, really," Ruddock said. "It could have been about anything, I suppose. Like, did they ever see him pinch coins from the collection plate? Or had he been badly injured as a boy and in need of pain medications? Or had he ever had a behaviour change with no way to account for it? What I'm saying here is that those are my speculations, because aside from saying he wanted to have a word with the parents, and did I know how to contact his mum since she's a copper, he didn't tell me much of anything."
"Finn Freeman's been something of a recurring theme, we're finding," Linley said.
"Along the lines of all roads leading to him," Barbara put in.
"I wish I could tell you more," Ruddock said, "but that's the extent of it."
Do you recognize any of the other numbers registered on Ian Druitt's messages and phone calls? Lindley asked. He nodded at the phone that was still in Ruddock's hand. Ruddock cooperatively gave all this a look, but his expression was one of regret. He clarified this with, "I've got to say, I'm dead rotten at this. Way I do things with my own phone, I just find the name on my list and tap it. I can barely remember my own number, let alone anyone else's. I mix them up, see? I put them backwards and the like." Barbara remembered that, from the first, Ruddock had been in the open about his learning difficulties. She gave Lindley a fractional nod. A silence grew. Lindley and she did their best presentation of being deep in thought. Barbara with her arms crossed and her lips pursed as she gazed upon the hideous grey lino, he with a bent index finger touching the scar on his upper lip and his brow furrowed as he looked out of the window above the table at which they were sitting. After a good 30 seconds of this, Lindley said, "There is one point we've come across. You might be able to help with it."
"I'm that happy to," Ruddock said.
"It has to do with the night Mr. Druitt died. You've told my sergeant that you spent some time away from him making phone calls to the town's pubs, once you learned about the binging going on, and during that period of making calls to the pubs, Mr. Druitt hanged himself.
I've been that sorry from understood.
But in looking at the number of pubs in Ludlow, and considering the time required to ring them all about shutting down for the night..."
"It was just about not serving college-age drinkers, sir," Barbara put in.
"Yes, of course, not serving young drinkers." And to Ruddock, "My sergeant and I have begun to wonder why it took you the amount of time you've said it took to make those calls. Barbara?" She made much of going back over her notes.
"Nearly 90 minutes, sir."
"So we've begun to ask ourselves what else might have happened during that time."
"Nothing."
But there was colour in Ruddock's cheeks that had not been there before. Barbara did the leaning forward this time. She said,
"Gary, when I was here first time round, I popped by the station one night. It was, I don't know, round 10:30. There were no lights on, but there was a patrol car in the back, in a car park."
"Generally there is," he said.
"This patrol car was in the shadows. It was as far from the building as it could be. I know that doesn't mean anything in the normal course of events, but on this night, when I was here, I mean, a young woman got out of that patrol car. Then you did. Then you and she had something of a stare down. Then the two of you got back in and stayed there."
Ruddock said nothing. He was perfectly still.
"So," Barbara said, using the word as a full stop before she went on with, "males and females inside a car parked deep in the shadows at night. What does that suggest to you?"
He began to reply, but Barbara wasn't finished, so she said quickly,
"Now, what I remember is you telling me that you didn't have anyone in your life of a girlfriend nature. If that's the case, I had to lie to you."
Colour was climbing up his neck, turning his skin into a burning bruise.
"If I said the truth, you would have gone to her. I couldn't have that. I'm sorry about it all. I know everything's my fault. I know what happened with the deacon is down to me, but I couldn't just announce. No one could in my position."
This bore some sorting through. Barbara glanced at Lindley to see what he was making of it. He said to the constable, "I'm assuming you mean that on the night Druitt died, in addition to making the phone calls to the pubs, you also had..."
"Sex," Barbara put in,
knowing Lindley's inclination to use polite euphemisms, gent that he was.
"A prong in the pudding, as it were, in a car park inside the patrol car."
Ruddock averted his gaze.
"It had already been arranged, her and me. This was before I was told to fetch him. And even then no one told me what was going on with Mr. Druitt, the paedophile thing. I was just told to bring him in and wait for the patrol officers, so I expected. What I didn't expect was what happened."
"You left him unattended." Lindley waited for Ruddock to nod, then he said, "Which gave him time to hang himself."
"Or gave someone else time to fake his suicide," Barbara added.
And when Ruddock quickly turned to her, she added,
"You do see how that could have happened, eh? You and whoever she is, out in the shadows, going at it like ferrets, and someone gaining access to the station, someone who knew you and the nameless female would be doing just what you were doing."
"No," Ruddock cried.
"It couldn't have, not that way."
"You understand we'll need her name," Lindley told him.
"We're ticking boxes here, Gary," Barbara added, "and whoever she is, she's one of them." "It's nothing to do with her," he said hotly. "She doesn't know. She didn't know Druitt."
"Perhaps that's the case. But she'll need to confirm that," Lindley said.
"She'll also, when you come down to it, be providing you with an alibi, Gary."
That stopped him exactly where they wanted him, Barbara saw, directly on the edge of the precipice. He could plunge over or he could retreat. He was running out of options. He said hoarsely,
"I can't have her dragged into this. She's married. What's happened is down to me. I was derelict in duty. No one else was."
"Then we're going to need your mobile, Gary," Barbara told him. "We're going to have to search for her. You do see that, don't you? It's easier for all of us if you hand it over. There's less official involvement that way. It stays between us. If we have to go the route of a warrant, then, well, everyone knows, eh?"
They were at it. It all came down to what the PCSO wanted and did not want others to know, particularly his superior officers. Barbara and Linley were relying on the fact that Ruddock's self-interest would supersede everything else. It did. Ruddock handed over his mobile.
"You do know that if she's on here, we're going to find her," Linley told him. "So is there anything you want to tell us in advance before we begin checking on your calls?"
Ruddock said, "She's not on there."
"We'll be determining that, of course," Linley said. "Is there anyone on here you want to tell us about before we work it out on our own?"
Ruddock considered this, directing his gaze to the window.
When he finally looked back at them, it was impossible to tell if he'd decided to lie or had been dwelling on the ramifications of what he was about to say.
"There's calls you'll see to and from Trev Freeman."
"The DCC's husband," Barbara clarified.
"He asked me to keep an eye on Finn.
He's been a handful at home. Trev thought if I was, well, sort of a big brother to him, because, see, Trev and Plo..."
"You seem closer than normal to the DCC." Barbara couldn't imagine calling the Gov Isabel, and trying Dave on Hillier would doubtless get her booted down the nearest stairway.
"Oh, I would never call her by a first name in company or the like. It's just that... Look, she took me under her wing a bit. She introduced me to her family, particularly to Finn. I liked him, and he liked me."
"Got it," Barbara said, and then to Linley. "Sir?" He nodded.
"I think we have what we need." He rose to leave and then added, "But it is surprising, nonetheless," he said.
"What's that?" Ruddock asked him.
"How so much that we've learned takes us to this boy Finnegan Freeman." They left him then, his mobile phone in their possession. As they climbed back into the Healy Elliot, Barbara said,
"I'd wager he's racing to the landline as fast as he can, ringing every number he can remember. There's going to be some he knows by heart."
"Perhaps," Linley said. "But I don't actually doubt him when it comes to the phone, Barbara. Don't you find that technology is eliminating brain power in virtually every area of life? Why memorize a number? Why even write it in an actual address book or diary when one can merely tap a name on a smartphone and
bobs you whatever?" Havers finished.
"Right, I get it. Thus, technology doth make numbskulls of us all." Barbara offered him an instructive look.
"Inspector, do you ever plan to advance into the current year? Or decade? Or even century?"
"Something Helen asked me often enough," he said, smiling. "Although since she never quite managed to work out how the microwave operated, I think she'd forgive me the sin of Luddism."
"Humph,"
was Barbara's reply. "The real point is that we have his phone." He lowered the Healy Elliot's window but did not start its engine. He went on with, "Let me ask you, Sergeant, did you believe the bit about the calls to and from Trevor Freeman?"
"About a son, Finnegan? The entire watching over of the son?"
And when Linley nodded, she went on with,
"He could well want watching over, sir. The Gov found him something of a piece of work, I can tell you that."
"Then you and I shall have a word, and see how we find him."
Worcester, Herefordshire.
Trevor Freeman had to admit that he and his wife had begun their relationship as a veritable cliché. She had been a young detective, constable, employed in the city, newly out of training, ambitious to climb upwards in the police hierarchy. She'd been equally ambitious to remain in top physical condition, and in this cause she'd taken on a personal trainer. He'd been that trainer. From the first he'd found her compelling. So often he'd discovered that, given a few weeks of intense conditioning, both men and women began making excuses for their inattention and sloth. But not Clover. She showed up at the gym where he was employed. She did the work. She grunted. She sweated. And she didn't worry how any of this affected her looks. This, of course, made her immediately intriguing to him. He had pursued her, inviting her for a cup of coffee after a training session,
offering her a drink at the local, suggesting a meal together. But nothing worked. He was considering just moving on when his sister-in-law invited him to a small drinks party, to which she said she'd also invited a woman who, she thought, would be a good match for him. Someone she'd met at a charity run, she said. He'd gone,